This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One that you might like is Radical Technologies, The Design of Everyday Life by Adam Greenfield. Everywhere we turn, a startling new device promises to transfigure our lives. But at what cost? In this urgent and revelatory excavation of our information age, leading technology thinker Adam Greenfield forces us to reconsider our relationship with the networked objects, services, and spaces that define us. It is time to reevaluate the Silicon Valley consensus determining the future. We already depend on the smartphone to navigate every aspect of our existence. We're told that innovations, from augmented reality interfaces and virtual assistants to autonomous delivery drones and self-driving cars, will make life easier, more convenient, and more productive. 3D printing promises unprecedented control over the form and distribution of matter, while the blockchain stands to revolutionize everything from the recording and exchange of value to the way we organize the mundane realities of the day-to-day. And all the while, fiendishly complex algorithms are operating quietly in the background, reshaping the economy, transforming the fundamental terms of our politics, and even redefining what it means to be human. Having successfully colonized everyday life, these radical technologies are now conditioning the choices available to us in the years to come. How do they work? What challenges do they present to us as individuals and societies? Who benefits from their adoption? In answering these questions, Greenfield's timely guide clarifies the scale and nature of the crisis we now confront and offers ways to reclaim our stake in the future. Radical Technologies, The Design of Everyday Life by Adam Greenfield, out now in paperback from Verso Books. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. This started out, quite humbly, as a podcast about class warfare, broadly construed, in the United States. Since then, however, we've done episodes on Mexico, Colombia, Ecuador, Venezuela, Korea, Spain, and many on the larger questions posed by a U.S. empire in crisis. Today, we're talking about Italy, where a so-called populist alliance of the Five Star Movement and the right-wing Northern League just took over the government on an anti-migrant and Euroskeptic platform. My guest is David Broder, a historian of French and Italian communism and frequent contributor to Jacobin. Before we get this thing started, I wanted to let you know that we have an excellent weekly newsletter and also a bunch of socialist books, and you can get all of that by supporting us at patreon.com/thedig. That's patreon.com/thedig. Not long ago, we met our spring fundraising goal of 1,000 supporters on Patreon. But since then, we've lost a number of supporters because their payment information, i.e. credit cards, debit cards, have expired, or because some people only intended to donate for a limited amount of time. So we're down to closer to 990. With your help, we can get back over 1,000 supporters this week. Please help us re-reach our spring fundraising goal at patreon.com/thedig. Oh, and I'd like to correct an error. In my recent interview with Matthew Fry Jacobson, I referred to Rocky Balboa as having been from South Philly. Obviously, he's from Kensington. We regret the error and apologize to Philadelphians everywhere. Okay, here's David Broder. David Broder, welcome to The Dig.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's been quite a few hectic weeks and really years or even decades for Italian politics. But in terms of the last few weeks, the internet-y anti-establishment five-star movement and the right-wing anti-migrant league have formed a government. And initially, that government seemed in doubt because the person put forward to be economy minister was deemed too anti-euro. And that spooked a lot of different people and entities, the quote-unquote markets, the EU, and also Italian President Sergio Mattarella, who was initially moving to block the government. What happened and what's going on now?
The result of the election on 4th of March didn't really give any clear indication who the new government was going to be. The center-right and center-left traditional parties, so Forza Italia, led by Silvio Berlusconi, and then the Democrats, they together only got 34% of the vote, which meant there could be no government of the traditional parties. And so the Lega, the League, which actually campaigned in the election jointly together with Berlusconi, and the Five Star Movement, which stood by itself, they together had enough seats to form a government. They come from very different places politically, and so it seemed difficult, also because the Five Star Movement has always previously refused any kind of coalitions, even at the local level. So we actually had over 12 weeks in which no government was formed. The two parties then came together with a so-called contract of their joint platform for government and their proposed Prime Minister, Giuseppe Conte, who was totally unknown before. Those of us who were lazy
literally not a name that anyone even very closely following politics would be familiar with.
Yeah, indeed. So he was just like a law professor with a handful of publications. But I mean, I'll give an example, which is, people like myself looking to write an article about Italy might have wanted to look up the Wikipedia page for Giuseppe Conte. But there actually wasn't one even the day after his name had been put forward as prime minister, because he was literally a figure of no public renown. And he's very much seen as a puppet of the two parties. Basically, he was chosen because he has no independent decision making. There was a quite funny incident actually when he was addressing the lower house, giving his speech to seek confidence for his government. He was caught on camera turning to the Five Star leader Luigi Di Maio, saying, and he said kind of under his breath, "Oh, can I also mention this?" And then Luigi Di Maio just like shook his head and said no. So yeah, he's an extremely weak figure. And indeed, there was also some discussion of whether it was actually even constitutional, because the constitution says the prime minister chooses the policy and chooses the ministers and then speaks with the president. So when the president, who's a supposedly sort of non-partisan figure, Sergio Mattarella, he's meant to just guarantee the constitution. So when he first met with Conte, there were a lot of rumors that he was basically not happy to accept him as the prime minister because he wasn't a serious enough and political enough figure. Then what happened was they proposed a list of ministers, one of which was chosen by the Lega, the economy minister, Paolo Savona, who had previously produced a PowerPoint in, I think, about 2014, saying, well, if Italy were to leave the euro, the way to do it would be to not announce in advance that you're going to do it and then take all sorts of measures sort of over the weekend while the markets are closed. And given that neither the Five Star Movement or the Lega campaigned on a pro-euro exit platform, and indeed their contract for government made no mention of leaving the euro or even making preparations for it, Mattarella was unhappy to have Savona as minister because he had indeed explicitly stated that he had a secret plan to draw Italy out of the euro.
So there's a bit of an irony there, because if one did want to secretly leave the euro, you probably wouldn't appoint as your economy minister a guy who wrote a paper explaining how to do just that, at least not if you're very smart about being secret.
Yeah, well, indeed. So the problem actually was, even in what Mattarella said when he announced what he wouldn't appoint Savona, he said part of the problem was that even naming Savona would have produced such a shock on the markets. There's a thing called the spread, which is the difference between German and Italian 10-year bond yields. So effectively, when it goes up, that means that the Italian yield is higher because investors are less confident in Italy's future.
Which in layman's terms means that Italy would have to pay a lot more to borrow.
Yeah, exactly. So this, and in kind of like Italian kind of media political discourse, this is always taken as the indicator of how well the economy in general is doing. And indeed, it's quite strange in a sense because they actually say it in English, lo spread, which given that we never say it in English, is rather bewildering to the uninitiated. So basically then he said he wouldn't accept Savona. The Lega said it wasn't happy to put forward another name. And then there was some talk of fresh elections, which in fact did cause the spread to surge even higher because basically the markets were more afraid of instability than a five-star Lega government. I will say that I don't actually think that either party does want Italy to leave the euro, although they both have campaigned for a referendum before, there are large parts of the Lega's sort of wealthier northern base who'd be very unhappy with actually quitting because effectively leaving the euro would amount to defaulting, so it would wipe out Italians' savings. So I think actually what they want and what the Savona affair actually was really just a kind of like political jockeying, sort of being seen to stand up against Europe and maybe to extract some kind of concessions over things like debt cancellation or borrowing, going beyond the deficit limits imposed by Europe. And that's what the Lega has been very successful at doing. And indeed, in those days when the government was in doubt, the Lega was absolutely surging ahead in the polls. So ultimately what they did was Savona was moved aside, although rather unusually became the Minister for EU Affairs, which isn't a particularly important position, and another more neutral economy minister was chosen. So that's the government we have now, Five Star and the Lega.
You write that the Fed Five Star has basically become an organizational vehicle for the Lega. So before we get any further, what is the Lega, or as it was called until quite recently, the Lega Norte, or Northern League? And who is Matteo Salvini?
The Lega Nord was founded in 1991, basically as a merger of several regional autonomy movements, all of them based in northern Italy. And at the outset, though, it wasn't exactly a hard or far right party. It kind of used a lot of rhetoric against the kind of lazy southerners combined with the sort of free spending, corrupt state focused in Rome, which, of course, is in sort of central Italy. So it demanded sort of cleaning up of the public accounts. In some regions, it was more kind of workerist and based on the old sort of ex-industrial areas, the old sort of former communist working class, whereas in others, it was more explicitly Thatcherite. And indeed, to that end, even had kind of liberal and pro-European elements. So the idea that the north of Italy could maybe even become independent of Italy, but be part of the then nascent European Union.
And create Padania. Is that
yeah.
right?
so Padania is a country that's never actually existed, and it means like the area around the Po Valley, the River Po. There's a famous photo actually with a Matteo Salvini himself wearing a T-shirt saying Padania is not Italy. Of course, the northern regions of Italy are much wealthier, and so there was for a time in the 1990s, the party did actually want to split away. It's not ever sort of come close to achieving that, but it has assured greater fiscal autonomy, greater budget autonomy for the northern regions, who therefore pay less of their tax take to Rome.
And like you said, it wasn't initially a hard right party. It had all different sorts of ideological currents, which makes sense in terms of them being a nationalist separatist force, because nationalist movements are typically cross-class alliances.
Yeah. So, and indeed, it was very determined to present itself as not right wing. So, rather oddly, it actually staged a general election for Padania, a totally unofficial parliament created by the party itself, in which lots of different political colorations were all representing Labour members stood. And people took this quite seriously. I mean, 6 million people, you know, like maybe about a third of the people who could have voted wow. did. And what's interesting is one of the parties that stood was the so-called Padanian Communists. And their leading candidate was one Matteo Salvini.
Oh, God.
Matteo Salvini was active in a social center, like an autonomous space in Milan in the early 90s. I think by the time they had the election, his sort of communism had certainly more than waned. But he comes from that tradition when he was a very young man. What happened though was that the party arose in a time of very general breaking down of the Italian political order. The Communist Party dissolved in 1991. It kind of in response to that, a lot of the other divisions working away within the other old parties, the Socialists and Christian Democrats, exploded. So you had this massive corruption scandal called Tangentopoli, like Bribesville. And that was the situation in which the Lega made its breakthrough as a national party under its then leader, Umberto Bossi. It wasn't necessarily for the hard right. So for example, in 1994, there was actually a government, a sort of technocratic, let's get the public accounts in order kind of government that was supported by the centre-left and the Lega Nord. So in that sense, it supported what was a very like mainstream neoliberal government. But for more of the last couple of decades, it was aligned with Silvio Berlusconi's party, which was Forza Italia. And it's normally made up part of that right-wing bloc.
And so how did the party become ideologically so right-wing in general and so anti-migrant in particular? And does Matteo Salvini's personal political trajectory just map onto that general shift in the party's politics, or has he traveled a more personal journey?
Well, I mean, I think certainly, I'd say his supposed left-wing affiliation was pretty brief and was very much when he was young. But nonetheless, his leadership of the party has very greatly changed its positioning. What happened really was that, as I said, the Lega actually started out partly as an anti-corruption party, and its leader, Umberto Bossi, throughout the 1990s and 2000s, he actually ended up himself in a corruption scandal and indeed was put on trial and convicted of fraudulent use of public funds and also treating the party's own finances as his own like personal bank account, basically. So he actually received a prison sentence and was forced out of the leadership in 2012. At the same time, there was a realignment of Italian politics because there was a government led by Mario Monti, a Goldman Sachs technocrat advisor, who led a supposedly non-political government, but which was backed in parliament by both the Democrats and then Silvio Berlusconi's party. And then
it's like Michael Bloomberg's dream government.
Yeah, exactly.
Except so, without him as president, his dream government involves him being in charge. But
for sure. And there's this very strange thing. It actually resurfaced recently when there was talk of having a technocratic government if the Lega five-star deal fell apart. It's that the president will elect a cabinet of technocrats who haven't been elected by the population. But then they go, oh, don't worry, like, we're not going to stand for election. So it's like, we're not going to stand next time. We're just going to like run the government and then leave it. But of course, that also creates the possibility for the government to do whatever it likes without ever facing any kind of popular judgment. So it's hard to see why that should be seen in positive terms. But the Monti government was backed by both centre-left and centre-right. And then after the 2013 election, those parties actually went into direct coalition together in having their own ministers and so on. That fell apart because of Berlusconi's fraud conviction. And that was when he was actually forced to do community service, when he was banned in an old folks' home, when he was banned from standing for parliament and so on. So while the Lega had, after Bossi's scandal and resignation had collapsed, 2013, both the fact of the Grand Coalition and the destruction of Berlusconi created the space for the Lega to become a very different kind of party. And that's when Matteo Salvini became the leader. And basically his plan was to turn the Lega from being a regionalist party and small ally of the centre-right into the main party of the Italian right. And indeed, one explicitly modelled on the Front National in France. So it would start to organise in every part of Italy. At first, the party remained called the Northern League, Lega Nord, but then had candidates called us with Salvini in the south, or like lists with the word Salvini in the name. And we really saw the fruits of that in the election in March, because Salvini was able to create a party that for the first time actually scored a higher percentage of the vote than Berlusconi's party. So Berlusconi's been the leader of the centre-right since 1994, and now this is the first time that he's been overtaken. And a big part of the way that Salvini was able to do that was by increasing the party in the south from literally not even standing and therefore scoring no votes to picking up a decisive, 5, 6, 7% in some of the southern regions, in Rome even 11%. And the glue of the basically more middle class northern support and the new vote in the south is anti-migrant sentiment and hostility to the refugees, bound up with a kind of discontent at the previous government's bad handling of the refugee crisis.
I find that absolutely fascinating and also, of course, terrifying that this party that wasn't just separatist, but also, as far as I've read, brazenly racist against Southern Italians, is able to hide that history, push that history to the side, and mobilize Italians up and down the peninsula under the banner of a formerly anti-Southern Italian party on the basis of anti-migrant politics.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's very interesting, actually, is when you connect it to the issue of, if you think really, obviously Italy is a country of emigration. Obviously, lots of Italians moved to the United States, but also other Western European countries. And you think, why would a country which has so much emigration and, so much migrant experience, nonetheless be so hostile to new arrivals? And then you get this kind of thing, which is much like actually with Southern Italians in the United States in particular, this sort of struggle to be perceived as proper whites. So therefore making them more racist and sort of a guard dog against other migrant groups. And so what you have in Italy now is the Lega used to say, well, Southerners aren't really Italians. They're half Arabs or Albanians or whatever. And now they've taken it one step further by including the Southern Italians, but against those other nationalities, against those groups. Of course, it's not just a matter of ideological positioning or people's sort of identity. It's also very bound up with, their success is very bound up with the disaggregation of the traditional parties, the economic crisis and such like. And I would assert again, the Lega isn't the biggest party in the southern regions, far from it. It's just that it's been able to add on a sizable, a million votes across the south, which for a party of its size is a big breakthrough, particularly considering it's in a system with proportional representation. To make that kind of breakthrough is amazing, really.
That's a fascinating parallel that you draw between Southern Italians joining up with the League and anti-migrant politics in Italy and the experience of Southern Italian Americans in the U.S. And I did an interview with Matthew Fry Jacobson, a historian at Yale who wrote this book, Roots 2, about the white ethnic revival in the U.S. And it's very much in part about how this, after facing intense discrimination in the early 20th century, how so-called white ethnics really carved out their own space within whiteness, very much in opposition to the black civil rights agenda.
And also, what really caught my attention this week, actually, so the Lega's governor in Veneto, which is like the northern region to the north of Venice, he basically, like Salvini said on last Saturday, for the migrants, the party is over. And that same day, 60 migrants died off Tunisia in a shipwreck. And also the same day, a Malian migrant worker, Sumaila Sacco, was murdered in Calabria. There's an article about it on Jacobin by Abubakar Soumara. And so after all of that happened, the governor of Veneto gave this speech in a campaign rally in the local elections there, where he compared the Italian migrant experience to the Africans arriving in Italy now. And he said this thing, which was like, you know, when your grandparents went off abroad, you know, they weren't filling up the jails. They were doffing their caps and saying thank you to their bosses.
This brings us to something that I think is really important to discuss, which is what might happen to migrants once this new government starts implementing policy. And if you could contextualize that by explaining a bit about the current situation with migrants in Italy, both concretely in terms of their current condition and also the politics that have been developing around them well before this government took office.
I mean, I think there's a well-justified sense of alarm at what the Lega and Five Star are talking about. So the Five Star movement has some representatives, most notably Roberto Fico, who's the chair of the lower house of parliament, who have said kind of pro-migrant things, solidarity with people struggling to make it from North Africa and so on. And yet the new government's contract is entirely determined by the Lega's agenda. So it specifies the deportation of 500,000 illegal immigrants. Even before the election, Luigi Di Maio, who's the Five Star leader, had said that there should be a target of no migrant boats arriving in Italy. And it, kind of typically of the way in which the Five Star is a very kind of two-faced movement, this is posed both as like, well, we don't want any refugees or migrants here because we don't want to have to deal with them. And then this kind of fake humanitarian point, which is like, well, we should be helping the migrants in Africa rather than them having to come here.
Which Trump also says about migrants from refugees from Syria.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, it's a farcical argument because, of course,
entirely,
the majority of the migrants actually do stay in the, actually in the Syrian example, you know, most of the refugees are in, go to Lebanon. You know, there's this Malian migrant worker the other day who was killed. And people say, well, you know, why are all these Malians coming over here? But it's like, no, you know, 3% of them are coming to Europe. Most of them are in places like Niger. The Lega has absolutely stamped its, you know, placed its stamp on the government's agenda on migration. And the rhetoric is very harsh. So all this kind of the party's over, aiming to stop any arrivals and so on.
Which we should point out is creating an ongoing bloodbath in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's been this this case the last couple of days about this this ship called the Aquarius, which Salvini he sort of said it's not going to be allowed to land in Italy, and so the boat is stuck in the Mediterranean. The Spanish government's offered to take it. But yeah, you know, thousands of people die every year in crossing the Mediterranean. And in this specific case, I mean, they're not their situation is very desperate. So it's very worrying. And it's, you know, very worrying to see the kind of popular support for this kind of, you know, or the success of this kind of rhetoric. Of course, Salvini as interior minister doesn't actually have any right to declare the ports closed or such like, and the Five Star have completely gone along with it. You know, the Prime Minister Conte and also Danilo Toninelli, who's one of the leaders of the Five Star Movement. You know, they have gone along with this. You know, it's basically a stunt by Salvini. You know, he posted a picture of himself on Twitter, like with his arms crossed and the hashtag, like, we're closing the ports. And now that when the Spanish said, well, we'll take the boat, this Aquarius I mentioned with 629 refugees, Salvini declared. I think part of the explanation of the success is, of course, it's very much, you know, Italy has few settled migrant communities, very few people from ethnic minorities in public life, not a very strong history of anti-racist movements. And antipathy towards migrants is doubtless the structuring thing. But nonetheless, we can also point to things like, other reasons which help explain why the Lega has been so successful in making ground on this issue. One of which is the scandal about the... there's a thing called the Dublin Agreement, which basically means that when migrants arrive in a particular EU country, that country has to keep them there rather than just allow them to continue traveling through Europe. Of course, the migrants arriving in Italy, who mostly arrive from either Tunisia or Libya, they don't want to come to Italy. Italy is known for its violent racism, doesn't have a welfare state, doesn't have well-established migrant communities. But the EU makes Italy keep them there.
Which I think it brings up an important point, which is that the response to the election from the EU and German government, the German government that runs much of the show in Europe, has been so scolding of Italy, and scolding in such a way that threatened to scuttle the choice of Italian voters, however horrific that choice was. But looking back in recent years, as you point out, European migration policy has failed to resettle migrants, so they end up getting stuck in basically the front door countries to Europe. And then on the economic front, it's Northern Europe and the Troika that's played such a central role in imposing austerity on Italy. So to what degree do these two strands of policy coming from Northern Europe, the austerity and the migrant policy that fails to resettle migrants outside of border countries, to what degree do those two things combined really reveal that Northern Europe has a lot of responsibility for this new right-wing government being in power?
I think it's certainly true that a lot of the rhetoric coming out of Berlin and the European institutions, and indeed a lot of the foreign press, totally plays into Salvini's hands, because exactly what he wants to portray is this battle between Italian democracy, Italians having their say, and then bad outside powers telling them what to do or saying that Italians are stupid and such like. So we've seen a lot of, when the government was sort of briefly stalled by Mattarella refusing the economy minister Savona, basically every single thing that any foreign press outlet said about it was immediately weaponized by Salvini to show that Europe doesn't believe in democracy, that Italians aren't allowed to choose for themselves. However, I think it's also important to push back against some of the claims that he makes. I mean, even the economy minister thing is a little more complicated in the sense that the Lega and Five Star didn't actually stand in the election on a pro-Italexit platform, in favor of leaving the euro. So, and Paolo Savona is just an old, he's an economist. He doesn't have any sort of elected political role. So the Lega very much wanted to portray it as the voters' choice is thwarted, but the voters hadn't chosen either him or the policy in any meaningful way. However, the fact of people like Merkel and someone speaking about the Italian government's composition allowed him to get away with that. Again, with the migrant thing, I mean, it's true that the European Union and Dublin Agreement force Italy to keep migrants on Italian soil. But it's not actually true that Italy has for example, Italy has taken far fewer refugees than Germany itself. And a big part of the reason why the refugee crisis has become such a heated issue recently is that the basically Italy is paid to keep the migrants on its soil. And then there was this scandal in 2014, which was basically called Mafia Capitale, which was basically that the Rome city government was hiring contractors to run the centres to keep migrants in them, like so-called shelters, but they're more like detention centres. And basically, the people who got the contract to run these facilities were just mafiosi who were basically like stealing the money. So there's a kind of internal and domestic Italian corruption and incompetence that you know greatly aggravates the situation and also feeds a kind of general distrust for the Italian state itself, so among the population and among the categories likely to vote for Five Star and Lega. I mean, I think what Salvini's been skillful in doing is you know really the migrant issue is the firstly the most emotive one and also the one that has like no real risk for him politically because the general climate is just so strongly hostile. So he makes it an issue of Europe needs to listen to us, Europe needs to take responsibility for these migrants and so on. And that really allows him a series of kind of set piece clashes with Brussels and to pose as the defender of democracy while on the euro thing, you know, he doesn't want to leave the euro. And I think that's very unlikely to happen.
And so what about European complicity on the economic front?
Without doubt, like Italy has very deep structural economic problems. For example, things like demography, you know, having extremely old average population, very poor infrastructure. And the crisis has been going on for almost 30 years, in a sense. I mean, if you look at, say, since 1992, which was also the year of the collapse of the old political parties, the end of what was called the First Republic. Basically, from that point onwards, Italy has grown less than half as much as France and also has you know, sky-high youth unemployment and so on. I mean, I think the specific problem so although there were doubtless very severe problems before the euro was introduced between 1999 and 2002, the real effect of the euro has been to prevent Italy from having any tools to extricate itself from the crisis because it has a 2.4 trillion euro public debt, which it has no way of like inflating away or cancelling in the manner of, say, a country like Japan, which you might say has a lot of who has similar kind of demographic problems and such like. And also because of the EU limits on budget deficits, it's not allowed to borrow and invest in infrastructure as much as it would like. So I think it's kind of trapped in the crisis. And Italy is actually one of, I think, only two countries in the Eurozone that hasn't actually yet recovered to 2008 GDP levels.
And this is a problem shared across Southern Europe, these basic institutional contradictions in the Eurozone.
Part of the problem really is it's very hard to talk about reforming it because, you know, as I said, you could do stuff like cancelling the debt, which would have a real positive effect. But the much more fundamental problem is that by its very nature, because it has a fixed exchange rate for all Eurozone countries, by definition, the effect of the euro is basically to make German exports cheaper and the German currency, as it were, artificially cheap. Whereas for Italy, it's artificially expensive. And its exports are artificially expensive relative to wage levels. So Italian manufacturing has actually fallen by, I think, 30% in the last 10 years, which is really dramatic. But then the problem is that the actual, I'd say, you know, if you look at opinion polling and so on, we find that the majority of younger Italians are, in fact, for leaving the euro. Although kind of anecdotally, I'd say the majority sentiment is probably a bit like, it's too difficult. It's like the euro has been a disaster, but it would be too difficult for us to leave, and people don't have the faith in like the state or the particular government like this one to actually sort of successfully politically out of it. So what you have is a kind of generalized like malaise and lack of faith. You know, when the euro was launched, it was launched amidst very great optimism and a lot of big promises about the stability it would bring. That's all been disappointed, and yet it's very hard to think of any alternative or way out.
I'm Aziz Rana, and you're listening to The Dig, a great place for analysis about where we are, how we got here, and what can be done. It's my favorite podcast, and you can support it at patreon.com.
This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon and by the Socialism 2018 Conference. If you like this podcast and want to connect with other radicals in real life, you should come this summer. The Socialism Conference is 4 days of political education, debate, and camaraderie. It takes place July 5th through 8th in Chicago and features activists, authors, and people just like you from across the country and around the world. Featured speakers include Boots Riley, Dave Zirin, Sarah Jaffe, Anand Gopal, Amy Goodman, and many more. The conference is packed with talks on everything from eco-socialism and climate change to black athletes in revolt to debates around topics like gun violence, resisting the police, socialists and elections, and the fight for universal health care. There will also be discussion about the movements of today, like Me Too and Black Lives Matter. And Socialism 2018 will feature leaders of the teachers' strikes that have swept through the so-called red states this spring. Teachers from West Virginia to Puerto Rico to Arizona will speak on two panels in Friday night's main plenary. Don't miss this opportunity to learn about the power of organized workers from rank-and-file leaders across the country. Socialism is co-sponsored by the Center for Economic Research and Social Change, ISO, Haymarket Books, Socialist Worker, and by Jacobin. And it will feature talks with Jacobin contributors on lessons from the current teachers' rebellion, the movements of 1968, Bernie Sanders, the future of the socialist left, and more. The conference is also a great place to learn the basics of Marxism. To learn more about the conference and to register, visit socialismconference.org. That's socialismconference.org. So speaking of malaise and lack of faith, we need to talk a bit about the Five Star Movement, which we haven't gotten into very, very sure. deeply. You write that it's become a sort of vehicle for Lega policies in this government because its own sort of anti-version of anti-politics, I guess, leaves them pretty vulnerable to that. And this is perhaps, I mean, the most slippery political force on earth that I'm aware of. It's by no means a left force, but you write that it is, its success is very much an outcome of the left, the Italian left's collapse. Explain what you mean by that, who the Five Star Movement is, and why the Italian left for a long time, maybe not recently, but for a long time, one of the strongest in Europe, why it has collapsed.
Starting with the question of the collapse of the Italian left, I mean, it has a lot to do, of course, with the fact that the biggest left party by far was the Communist Party, which, although it in some ways distanced itself from the Soviet Union in the 1970s, nonetheless remained sort of bound up with the communist identity. It had many sort of internal sensibilities, some of which were more kind of linked to the legacy of 1917, the idea of ultimate revolution, even the idea of a kind of big socialist change in society, particularly among the base, and then currents in it which were more sort of social democratic. And in the post-war decades, the fact that the Communist Party wasn't really allowed or able to join the national government, even in coalition, even in the so-called historic compromise of the 1970s with the Christian Democrats, it was never actually in government. So what the party was a bit like was it had this kind of endless gradual electoral rise, strength in kind of regional governments where it could carry out progressive policies, for example, to the creation of something like a welfare state in its own regions, free public transport in Emilia-Romagna, that kind of thing. Control of the unions, a very large base of kind of cooperatives, of which I think 7 or 8 million Italians were members, both workers and consumer cooperatives. And it's all held together by this kind of promise that eventually it will succeed, eventually it will make it to government. But then basically when the Soviet Union collapses, that's also the death knell of the communist identity of the party, and the social democratic wing of it tried to create a Italian social democrat party such as had never existed in the 1990s. And that party was really from the outset very quickly gravitated towards the kind of Blairite and Clinton sort of third way of social democracy. And ultimately ended up as what's now called the Democrat Party, explicitly modeled on the US Democrat Party. Really, through the 90s and 2000s, the glue of its different elements, you know, some of which came from the old left, some of which were Christian Democrats and liberals, what really held them together was anti-Berlusconism. And opposition to Berlusconi also allowed it to draw in even parts of the radical left, most notably the party Rifondazione Comunista, which had not gone along with the idea of creating a democratic party, and which wanted to keep the old Communist Party alive. And basically this arrangement basically denied the left any distinct voice. So at the time of the 2006-2008 government, the radical left of Rifondazione actually voted for the war in Afghanistan, as in to continue financing the Italian involvement in the war in order to prevent the government falling and thus allowing Berlusconi into power. When one of the senators insisted on voting against the war, Rifondazione actually expelled him. So you saw Rifondazione, and also, you know, Rifondazione signed up to things like the European Fiscal Stability Pact, which basically is the underpinning of neoliberal rules on borrowing in the European Union, also in the name of sort of keeping the centre-left in power, the so-called centre-left, this Democratic Party, as it later became. So it really failed to maintain a sort of anti-establishment left-wing force. It was constant. The threat of Berlusconi, Berlusconi's own coalition obviously included sort of ex-fascist parties, and indeed also included the Lega at an earlier stage of its development. The threat was real, but the radical left was constantly drawn into these coalitions, uniting the whole like neoliberal centre and centre left, and unable to forge a distinct force for itself.
This sounds very familiar to the U.S. situation, where so many establishment liberals would love nothing more than some grand anti-authoritarian alliance with people like Bill Kristol. Absolutely. On the neocon right.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the resistance, and in the Berlusconi years, the Democrats would often criticize him from the right, from the perspective of, you know, we need to be more serious about the public accounts, about cuts, that he's a clown, basically all the stuff we hear about Trump. And indeed, this actually even led in 2011. What actually happened in 2011 was that the Berlusconi government was not implementing the budget deficit cuts required from Brussels, and the President of the Republic, together with Mario Draghi of the European Central Bank, more or less conspired in order to remove Berlusconi from office in order to impose a cabinet of unelected technocrats. And this was very much with the support of the Democratic Party. Also, of course, in the 2008 was the moment of the financial crisis, and this was precisely when the Five Star Movement got going. It first had a series of so-called meetups. Meetups is a now forgotten social media site, and you had local groups.
I never forgot.
Yeah, it's like MySpace, but with less interaction. So Beppe Grillo organized these so-called meetups. And the idea is like all the parties are the same. They're all corrupt. And we're going to create a movement that's not a political party. And that's what Five Star is. And it first started standing in the elections in 2009. Unlike, say, Rifondazione, the radical left party, which was always in power together with the center left, Grillo's movement from the outset was like, we're never going to go into, it projected a much more anti-systemic aura. So it was like, our representatives aren't going to go on TV or do interviews. In fact, expelled some of its MPs precisely because they went on TV in a now long forgotten phase of its development. Everything was going to be decided by online vote, and they weren't going to enter into any horse trading with other parties. So the party built, and it is a party, a five-star movement built itself up precisely by having this kind of image of differentness, of not playing by the rules of politics, indeed of not being staffed by politicians, particularly in 2011 between 2011 and this year, there were various forms of technical government or coalitions between center-left and center-right. So that really helped the movement both to pose as something very different and to define itself against the political parties saying that they're all the same, but without actually defining a political line of its own. It claimed to be above left and right. It drew in a lot of, drew in a lot of former left-wing voters. There was a poll after the election on 4th of March showing that more people who voted communist in 1987, more of them voted for the five-star movement this time than voted for the center-left, for the Democrats.
That's sobering.
So I'd say the movement's strongest base of support, although far from exclusive, it claims to be sort of not a particular class or not left or right. But the reason why I say it's replaced the left is its strongest support is among unorganized parts of social groups that you would otherwise expect to vote for the left. Among unemployed people, it has 50% of the vote. Among under 44s, it has about 45% of the vote. Particularly in the southern and therefore poorer parts of Italy, in many it scores well over 40% of the vote. So it represents a kind of elements of the population which are very hit by the crisis, and as I say, not just the 2008 crisis, but which have over the last 30 years, lost the ability to get a job. So in Italy, there's over 35% youth unemployment. A lot of people feel that the reason they can't get a job is because of patronage, is because the old parties and their cliques control everything, including in the public sector, in fact, which also leads the Five Star movement to tend to be quite hostile to trade unions, because in its essential, if it had a political message more, if I were to distill it from its ideology, which it doesn't sort of explicitly say. Basically, its idea is a bit like the individual who can't get a job and who is faced with patronage and with institutions that don't work, it is going to take measures so that that individual can make a career for themselves.
And so they have this intense focus on corruption, which, as you noted earlier, so did the Northern League. And I think that both parties have this focus and history of anti-corruption tells us a lot about how anti-corruption politics often operate more generally, looking at Brazil, for example.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, because basically it postulates this kind of imaginary situation where it's like the state is untrustworthy, so we don't want to call for big public investment projects because everyone knows that they won't work. So the way to make it possible for people to find work and to make politics serve the population is to kind of cleanse the state of of corrupt individuals. As I mentioned in the article I mentioned earlier, in the Lagos case, it's amusing because, in fact, the leader Umberto Bossi, who led the party on this like anti-corruption ticket and complained against thieving Rome and so on, himself turned out to have embezzled both party funds and state funds. And also, there's actually a liberal party called Italy of Values, led by Antonio Di Pietro, which was part of the left center-left coalitions in the 2000s. Di Pietro was the lead prosecutor in the Bribesville trials of the early 1990s. It was with some joy that I received the news when basically Di Pietro was revealed to own 56 houses.
Wow.
More
than that's more than John McCain.
Not a hero for me.
Real heroes by 50 something houses.
Yeah, and also the nature of his defense was quite suspicious because he kind of said, well, you're counting 56 houses, but actually some of them are just like garages, or like it's counting the number of buildings rather than the number of properties. So the real number is only like, 40.
So on the Five Star Movement, another thing that I want to underline in terms of their anti-political posture, you write that they in the past have refused to take enforced kind of a non-position on issues like gay marriage and abortion.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's really interesting about what's happening now, because in the past, they have always refused to take positions on so-called divisive social issues, because they say the Democrats are using this kind of progressive social policy as a distraction from the real issues of unemployment or of corruption or of whatever. So although the party is meant to be organized on the basis of online direct democracy, because it's so vacuous, it always has to avoid making a choice on anything that might divide its base, which worked a lot more easily before it started to enter local government and then to become a serious contender for national government.
Yeah, when you govern, you actually have to have positions on everything.
Yeah.
Turns out.
They always have this thing of kind of keeping the decisions at arm's length. I mean, even now. As I said, they have this policy of like no coalitions. And in, I think it was in December, Luigi Di Maio said in an interview with La Stampa that he might consider a coalition with either the Lega or Liberi e Uguali, which is a small center-left party. And then Beppe Grillo, the movement's founder, went ballistic and forced Di Maio to stand with him and like in public sign a contract saying no coalitions. Because, of course, the problem is everyone's wondering, is this movement left or right wing? And then, of course, when it does align with another party, then you see its true colors and who it really stands for. And now, of course, although anyone would of course say that this is a coalition government between the Five Star and Lega, but the Five Star members insist on saying that it's not, and that it's just a government contract with a limited program of reforms, and that the parties remain like radically different and so on, and they'd never stand together in elections. But of course, what we can see is that the Lega is totally imposing its agenda on Five Star. So as a further example of the kind of slipperiness, I mentioned earlier this Roberto Fico, who is the chair of the lower house of parliament. And he paid a visit. So when the Malian trade unionist Soumaila Sarko was murdered, Roberto Fico visited the Tendopoli, like the city of tents and shacks where this worker had lived. And he met with some of the fellow migrant workers there. And he expressed his solidarity with them, his sorrow at the murder of Soumaila Sarko and so on. And some journalists asked him how he could feel all of these sentiments himself and yet nonetheless be in a government with the Lega. And he said, no, you're wrong. I'm not in the government. I'm just the chair of the lower house, which is technically true. I mean, he doesn't have a ministerial role in the government. He just has a institutional role but which nonetheless owes to the fact that
his party is in government.
So it's a nonsense. But actually, when you if you like, I try engage in online combat with the Five Star people, they really believe this stuff, and they're very diehard in insisting on it. So I think actually a real problem is that it's kind of like, I think there was a, because as I say, a lot of old sort of former communist voters, former left-wing voters, working-class voters, just to illustrate that point, among blue-collar workers, the Five Star Movement got 40% of the vote, 4-0, whereas the Democrats got 13-1-3. So, you know, they have destroyed the left. So you have this kind of optimism, which is like, well, you know, the Five Star Movement pretended not to be right wing, but now it's in coalition with the Lager, so it will be kind of exposed, and then and then the voters will come back to the left. But what that doesn't really take account of is the fact that if the left isn't organized, there aren't visible struggles, people don't feel strength in their workplaces and so on, then they don't really exist as a class in a kind of political sense. And in fact, if anything, the polling movement we've seen over the last couple of months since the election is actually of Five Star Movement voters actually migrating to the Lager.
So they're actually building kind of like a politico-ideological bridge through their purported anti-politics to the far right for former left-wing voters. A key part of this that we've touched on, just, you know, as an aside a few times, of this purported deeply democratic anti-politics that Five Star practices is this internet obsession, and they put the accord with the Liga to an internet plebiscite, which has all the appearance and none of the substance of democracy. It explain this political style and what it reveals.
So what's interesting, there's a very good book called well, it's in Italian, but it's called The Experiment by Jacoboni, who I interviewed for Jacobin Sim before the election, where he talks about this guy, Gian Roberto Casaleggio, who was the founding guru of the Five Star Movement. He was like Beppe Grillo's like intellectual sidekick. In the 1990s, Casaleggio, the movement's guru, he took an interest in neuro-linguistic programming, which is like a kind of pseudoscience, but some of the he's actually organized, before he died a couple of years ago, he actually organized kind of retreats for the Five Star Movement's MPs, where they would receive talks on neuro-linguistic programming and also on hypnosis. So like some really cultish and strange practices. But one of the things he talks about in his writings in the 90s is about the emerging world of online discussion, Usenet forums, and that kind of thing. And basically, he explicitly talks about studying how to manipulate online discussion. So like he talks about stuff like what you should do is set up a sock puppet accounts. And you'll have one guy who ventures an opinion which you disagree with, and then you have two responses to it which are each much stronger than the original argument, by your own sock puppet accounts, and then you're bound to then see the discussion follows the way you want. So in Five Star, he was very into, he actually put some of this stuff into practice on their so-called Rousseau platform, which is the online platform of the Five Star Movements. One of the strange aspects of this is it's actually like a business. So it's like the private property of Casaleggio and now his son. Five Star officials were made to sign contracts in the early years when they weren't allowed to go on TV. They were made to sign contracts that they'd only release their public statements via Casaleggio-owned platforms, which would also allow him to collect the Google AdSense revenue.
God.
So it is really monstrous.
But it's kind of genius, though, because you have this, I mean, it's genius in a lot of ways, but this idea that you put all of these things to internet plebiscites gives this sense of the people having direct access to the political decisions made by elected officials, when in fact it's premised on the most undemocratic vision of democracy possible, which is these atomized individuals sitting on their phones or at their home computers, making, you know, just sort of like ratifying predetermined referenda questions.
Absolutely. So it's like, if you ask, yes, so firstly, it's the referendum form means the question's already decided in advance. And also it's like kind of like the five-star movement activist would tell you, we decided our program collectively, not like the other parties. Whereas in fact, what happened was they're proposed like the 10 platform points, and then they get to vote which will be prioritized. Not that it makes a great deal of difference anyway, because of course during the coalition negotiations between, De Maio, the leader of the Five Star Movement, he made coalition negotiations with the Democrats, which is the party the Five Star purports to hate most, and then with the Lega. And, you know, the members have no say over it whatsoever. It would be farcical to suggest they did. In January 2017, the Five Star Movement, which currently sits in the most Eurosceptic bloc in the European Parliament, so it's with the same group as like Nigel Farage. So basically, Beppe Grillo decided that he wanted to try and join ALDE, which is like the most liberal and pro-European one. So it has people like the English Liberal Democrats, Guy Verhofstadt, who's a Belgian, totally like a Euro federalist. And then the Five Star Movement voters voted in their online opinion poll. As I say, it's like, you know, they don't have any like meetings or like debates or anything. It's like Grillo puts out the question, then they vote. And they voted by 78.5% to make this complete political flip. So having been in an apparently very right-wing Eurosceptic group, they voted by almost 4 in 5 to join the most liberal and federalist one. And then ALDE said, like, well, of course you can't join. You disagree with us on everything. So then the decision was just, like, ignored. And Beppe Grillo phoned up Nigel Farage to say, oh, sorry, it was all a big misunderstanding. And in this election... So when the Di Maio made the government contract with the Lega, and he put it, you know, it had been going on for like 12 weeks, and then he says, like, okay, here's this contract. You have like 8 hours to vote with like no discussion or debate or any kind of public, even like public debate between the movements, like well-known public figures. You have 8 hours to vote. Should we go for this deal? And the result was a 94% yes vote on a 40% turnout, which for the movement, Five Star Movement, is actually quite a high turnout. So, you know, just like a really farcical and meaningless vote, because the members just don't have any say. And yet, as I say, and you say yourself, it's very clever because it gives all of the appearance of removing barriers between the private individual and then political life. What it actually does is it destroys all of the intermediate institutions, the local branches, the elected officials, the media, all that kind of thing, that would actually allow an ordinary person to have an influence over national political life.
That's very well put. One bizarre thing about that is that the Five Star Movement had, maybe not anymore, I hope, but had some admirers on the American left and the left elsewhere. What was that about?
Well, I mean, I think there's some reasons. I mean, you know, obviously the Five Star Movement rose from being, you know, nothing. You know, it had one big public figure, Beppe Grillo, who's a comedian. And with apparently without the deployment of a great deal of resources, it rose from being nothing to a party which 4 years after forming got 25% of the vote in the national election, and in 8 years into its existence got 32% in the national election. So doubtless anyone in a small left-wing party will look hopefully to this experience and think they could do the same. Also, of course, a lot of mainstream media do portray it as left-wing. So, for example, in while the talks were taking place a couple of weeks ago, I watched a video on BBC Newsnight, which is the most prestigious BBC current affairs program, which described the five-star Labour deal as like if Momentum from the British Labour Party joined up with Nigel Farage, and it referred to five-star as alt-left and indeed extreme left.
Much of this then seems to stem from this generally confused debate about populism, which is just used by sort of establishment figures as a derogatory term for right and left movements that they don't like. That obscures a lot more than it clarifies. And so we end up with no useful analysis of Five Star from mainstream publications. Like the first time I read about Five Star in the New York Times, I was like, I don't get it. This article did not explain this movement to me in anything close to a satisfactory manner.
I think actually, although in a way I'm just like a puffing up my own analysis, but I think it's like, it's actually a lot more interesting to look at it not in terms of populism and to look at it precisely in terms of like individualism. As in, it reflects the consciousness of the person who doesn't believe in state action and who doesn't feel any value in collective action and doesn't feel any sense of like solidarity or anything.
Let me quote from you. You write, "While it purports to stand for an apolitical common sense, it in fact expresses the particular common sense of an era in which atomized, crisis hit individuals distrust public institutions and do not see collective action as a viable solution to their problems."
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have put it better myself, and I didn't. So I think, like, also, I mean, if you think of it, okay, so like, there was a piece in the New Left Review in which which effectively sort of drew a certain comparison between it and parties like Podemos, and I think perhaps also France Insoumise, which and certainly in French press, it's often bracketed with that party. But actually, if you read Five Star Movement stuff, they never talk about the Italian people, or still less class. They talk about citizens. They're talking to individuals, and they don't have any kind of like rallying progressive project. They're pretty thin on policy detail at all. But I think it's easy to if you are a liberal centrist and you want to portray a kind of horseshoe theory about the meeting of extremes, and you want to discredit the left in your own country, then it makes sense to call the Five Star Movement a left populist movement. But from basically any other perspective, it makes no sense because it isn't left wing.
My last question is just a general one, which is where you see Italian politics heading from here. And of particular interest to my listeners, is there any short or medium term hope for the Italian left?
I think the current situation is doubtless a very negative one, because what we've seen indeed since the election is a radicalization to the advantage of the Lega. On March the 4th, the Lega rose from 4% last time to 17%. Now in the national polls, it's scoring as high as 27%, close to becoming the biggest single party. And in regional contests since the election, it's made huge breakthroughs in regions that had never before organized. On the migrant issue in particular, and also on the euro, he seems to be able to do all of the running. The centrist liberal parties really have little to say. And as I say, we're also seeing a movement of five-star voters towards the Lega, as if their own movement were just a kind of gateway drug towards the real thing. Nonetheless, I think that there are definite fractures within the government, which won't just be able to be sort of overwritten, or and nor will Salvini necessarily have his way. One of the most reactionary policies proposed by the government is a flat tax, so therefore as in making everyone pay the same tax rate. This already exists for some self-employed workers, but the plan is to generalize it to all Italians, possibly including having two rates, but still like relatively close to each other and also very low. This is projected to cause a 100 billion euro deficit in the public funds, and also would be enormously to the advantage of the richest Italians at the expense of poorer and indeed southern ones, the southern regions where the five star is strongest. So, for example, in by the predictions of the Lega's initial policy, a family on 300,000 euros a year would save almost 70,000 euros in taxes, whereas a family on 30,000 euros would save literally nothing, and would also see, of course, the effects of depriving the state itself of money in terms of public services being cut back, and so, and infrastructure investment, jobs in the public sector, and so on. So I think that portends a very definite clash between the parties, because I just really don't see how they're going to be able to implement that without having an obvious conflict over redistribution and who this government really serves. There aren't that many positive signs on the left. There's a centre-left party called Liberi e Uguali, free and equal, but really it's more kind of part of the old centre-left establishment that's now broken away, having seen the kind of Democrats go too far to the right. I don't really see that they have any kind of dynamism or really links to real social movements, even though the leader of the largest union confederation, Susanna Camusso of the CGIL, does support that party. I really don't see that going anywhere. Then there's a smaller radical left party called Potere al Popolo. We ran a couple of articles about them for Jacobin. That has its strongest base of support in an extremely impressive social center in Naples called Yeso Pazzo, and is definitely a sort of younger party and is trying to do something a bit more like a left populist party of a type with something like Podemos or France Insoumise, but doubtless is a very early stage of organization. Only got 1.1% of a general election. And I'd say also I think it got going pretty soon before the election, and the five-star movement had already hegemonized a lot of the kind of voters who that party might hope to win over. There are some notable social struggles, particularly the feminist movement against gender violence, Non Una Di Meno, and in certain sectors, particularly logistics and among migrant workers in particular, actually, we can see strike movements which are able to have some sort of echo at the level of national politics. But really, I don't see any clear issue or cause or group of workers which could become a kind of rallying point for the reconstitution of the left. I mean, as we were saying earlier, this is a country that used to have a communist party with 2 million members, which secured as high as 34% of the vote. And now it's probably the country in Western Europe with the very weakest left. In many ways, it looks a lot like countries, it's a country that used to have a big communist party, not a governing one, and where now the left barely exists. And in a sense, it's actually quite similar to countries like Poland or Slovakia or Hungary, where the political battle just doesn't include any kind of left-wing or egalitarian or internationalist voice at all. So you just have more or less authoritarian and social forms of neoliberalism. So I think currently the situation looks extremely bad, and there aren't a lot of signs for hope. Then again, for the reasons for optimism, listeners may be hoping for, I can offer any rather generic ones based on such things as In Britain, we didn't see Jeremy Corbyn coming. In the United States, no one saw Bernie Sanders coming. We knew that the discontent was there, but we hadn't seen it take any sort of progressive or really organized and explicit form. We'd only seen sporadic movements.
And that this government will no doubt fail to solve the contradictions that are already exploding in Italian politics and will continue to create new contradictions. And in those contradictions, you know, there will be opportunities both for good and for ill. But it seems like the only hope here is this generic but still very substantive hope that Italian politics has been impossible to predict and it will remain so.
Yeah, I mean, if I wanted something concrete to hang the chance of hope for, I think this flat tax thing really is it. Because while the flat tax does exist in some other countries, it was mainly kind of an instrument of creating a bourgeoisie and of wealth division in post-communist countries, whereas I think applying somewhere like Italy would just have such grave and disastrous effects on the poor and on public services that it wouldn't really be, I think it would be very difficult for it to succeed. Of course, what Lega hopes for is a war among the poor, that even as Italians get poorer and continue to be unemployed and hopeless, that they will turn their anger on migrants. And I think we should salute the work of those. So I mentioned earlier Abubakar, who wrote an article for Jacobin about the killing of the Malian migrant worker last week. And he's in the USB Union, which is a base union, a grassroots union controlled by its members. And despite, you know, it might sound like because it's radical, it's small, I think it actually has about 400,000 or 500,000 members. And they're working with workers who are very difficult to organize, you know, southern farm laborers among the poorest workers in Italy, earning €2.50 an hour maybe. And they're working to organize across the divide between migrants and Italian-born workers. So, you know, he's been on the TV studios in Italy the last few days and made something of a splash. So I think that kind of organizing work is really fantastic and offers some reason for something more than the kind of division and fighting among workers, which the Lega bases its strength on.
Well, David Broder, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
David Broder is a historian of French and Italian communism and frequent contributor to Jacobin. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once said, after noting that the more rotten the present representative system turns out and is acknowledged to be, the more desirable is it that it should be altered neither rashly nor radically. While other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We're posting new episodes every week, usually twice. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and please find us wherever you get podcasts, and subscribe. If it's on iTunes, please leave us a review. Those reviews help put us in touch with new listeners. So does you telling your friends, family, strangers about the show. All propaganda on our behalf is really great. And do find us at patreon.com/thedig. And make a monthly contribution to keep this thing running. Even a few bucks is a big help.